Okay, and we're live. So welcome. Today we have Dr. Chadwick Lane. Chad, do you want to take a moment and introduce yourself and a little bit about who you are and what you're doing?
Awesome, you bet. I just want to start by saying thank you so much, Zane and Gopu, for having me here, and really looking forward to having a conversation about some of the work that we're doing in neuropsychiatry at UT Southwestern. So again, yes, I'm Chad Lane. I'm a neuropsychiatrist in Dallas, Texas, UT Southwestern. And I wear a few different hats. My clinical and research hat is in working with people who have a diagnosis of functional neurological disorder, or FND for short. And I'll go into that in quite a bit of detail as we're talking. But it is a diagnosis that's gone by many names over the course of decades, including conversion disorder, but most recently, functional neurological disorder. And we're attempting to understand how interventions can help patients in terms of symptom severity, help improve quality of life, help improve their day-to-day functioning. And then the other hat that I wear is in education. I love to teach. I like to say I love to see patients, and I love to teach. And so my education role right now is as associate program director for our combined neurology psychiatry residency. Very, very proud of the fact that we get to be one of only four programs that provide a combined neurology psychiatry residency in the country. And I'll be happy to talk a little bit more about the different pathways to becoming a neuropsychiatrist.
Oh, thank you. So you're at UT Southwestern. Part of the purpose of, you know, Gopu and I's conversations, especially when we bring guests on, is kind of getting a sense of how you got to where you're at. You know, one of the highlights that we try to consistently vocalize is there's not a single pathway, and that pathway is inevitably not a straight line. And that is important, especially as young scientists, young physicians, young people that are looking to find themselves. It's good to keep that in mind, that it's not straight. It's often unpredictable at best. So where did you start off? What got you interested in the brain, right? And then I think what led you to medical school, and then especially to neuropsychiatry?
You bet, yeah. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's really our pathways in life are oftentimes serendipitous. I like to use the phrase seemingly insignificant decisions and choices, but end up having an enormous amount of significance in the trajectories we have. And that certainly applies to how I discovered my love of brain science and brain medicine. I went off to college thinking pre-med. I was starting high school around the time that cellular biology, stem cells, DALI was in the news. And so regenerative medicine was very much on my mind. And so I thought I had this pathway totally set the whole way for me. And I get to college and the registrar says, "Hey, you got to have full credits, and one of the classes you signed up for isn't available anymore. You got to choose something, or you won't be a full-time student." And I said, "Well, you got any recommendations? Have you heard any good stuff?" And the person said, I heard some good reviews about this class," and pointed to Psychology 101. I said, "Sign me up. Let's do it." I'd never really taken a brain-focused course, hadn't read much about neuroscience in high school, so I was ready to learn something new. And that semester changed the entire course of what would be my career. And I just fell in love with the idea of understanding brain-behavior relationships. What are the neural mechanisms that give rise to the human condition, to behavior and emotion and cognition? And so I was sold. I ended up majoring and declaring my major pretty shortly after that in neuroscience. Neuroscience at that time, University of Virginia, where I went to college, was an interdisciplinary major between psychology department and biology department, and loved it. I did some research as an undergraduate, and it started off by washing the glassware. I just was a first year emailing, "Hey, do you need anybody?" And would wash the glassware, help make the hydrochloric acid and all that. But eventually,
what kind of lab was it that you worked in?
Yeah, great. It was actually with Dr. Bettina Winkler, and she did molecular typing of adhesion molecules for neurons.
Oh, okay.
A lot of her research was around trafficking in the axon to the terminal. And so I was getting really, really granular in molecular in her lab and learned a ton. Learned how to do like vector splicing and
Oh man.
PCRs. So it was a wonderful experience.
So that was part of the neuroscience program at UVA. I mean,
It
it was truly interdisciplinary. You know, if you took a
Yeah.
psychology class and ended up studying
Neuroscience.
biomolecules of axon transport.
Exactly right. Yeah. It was, the didactic component was fantastic and hopping back and forth between the two different departments. But having those opportunities to really integrate it all together. And I felt like I had this unfair advantage because I get to molecular biology, which is like a pre-med rec, and I knew all about the plasmids and vectors and PCR because Dr.
Oh,
Winkler's
that's
lab
great.
taught me, like hands-on.
Yeah. That's great. What I'm curious, what was the class that did you not were you not able to take?
Oh,
Do you remember?
I don't. That's so funny. Yeah, I'd be curious. Maybe if I had taken it, I would have gone a completely different
Yeah,
route
you're like a poli
in
sci
my
major.
life. But
It's funny, my story is not un it's not too dissimilar. I also had to take a random semester because I was an aerospace engineer and figured out how bored I was gonna be doing that as a profession. I did an internship and I took all of my electives and one of them was intro psych and it was all about the brain. And same thing. Emailed all the faculty and I was like, whose lab can I get in? And that was it. I mean, that was funny.
That's
Maybe there are
right.
some consistencies between pathways, but
Yeah.
I have a question though. How does that link to the FND you are doing now? And before even that, what is functional neurological disorder? Because it's the first time I'm hearing. So what function are we talking about? What
Yeah.
disorders are we talking about, right?
Oh, I love that question, Gopu. You bet. I'm gonna dive deep into that. Before I do, I just want to say something for our listeners who
Yeah.
may be in training right now. Which is saying from your story, from my story, I think an important take home is don't hesitate to reach out, send those
Oh yeah.
emails, introduce yourself to people. That's how a lot of opportunities come about. I can't count the number of times that that's how I discovered a mentor or a project that had a huge influence on me and my training. So feel empowered to do that.
For sure.
But thank you, Gopu. And I think the connection between those early days of learning molecular and cellular neurobiology to functional neurological disorder, that's one of the beautiful things about neuroscience, is that you can draw a thread all the way from the gene to human behavior, to the structure of society. How cool that we're in a discipline that spans all the different levels from genes and proteomics and cellular biology to the manifestation of human consciousness. And it's so cool that every day we get to go to work and consider how on earth 120 billion neurons and maybe as many as a quadrillion synapses, depending on which paper you read, how this gives rise to all of that. So, functional neurological disorder, or FND, it's a condition that I would argue has probably existed since the dawn of human consciousness. It's really a disorder of consciousness. And one of the first people to kind of champion our understanding of how FND is seated in the brain was Jean-Martin Charcot. Dr. Charcot was a French neurologist, largely regarded as the father of modern neurology. And he had his name associated with a lot of things. He was actually one of the first people to operationalize our understanding of multiple sclerosis. There's Charcot's joint, which is when there's a deformity of the joint due to neuropathy. But the other important work that Dr. Charcot did was in what he then called, and many of his contemporaries would have called, hysteria. Now, important caveat, hysteria is a dated pejorative word that we no longer use. I'm a proud member of the FND Society, and we actually refer to it as the H word because it is a word that's founded in really incorrect ideas about what causes FND or the etiologies of FND. But one of Dr. Charcot's acolytes was Sigmund Freud, and Sigmund Freud used the term conversion disorder, the idea that there's this psychological conflict that can't get resolved psychologically, so it becomes converted into a somatic or physical symptom, a neurological symptom in the body. And then fast forward about a century, in 2013, this term was updated to functional neurological disorder, or more specifically, functional neurological symptom disorder, but we always shorten it to FND. And that's how we refer to it now. And if I was on an elevator and I had three floors and you said, Chad, what is FND? I would have to borrow the words of my colleagues and describe it as neurological signs and symptoms that are due to network dysfunction, but not due to a focal lesion in the nervous system, like a stroke or a multiple sclerosis plaque.
So is this something you can, I mean, if it's a functional disruption, this is detected on EEG then?
It's a great,
Are
great
there
question.
EEG signatures for that, or are there fMRI signatures?
Or
Or
behavior.
behavior? Yeah, or is it
I
behavior?
love those questions, right? So w in neuropsychiatry, we like to joke, you just scratch beneath the surface a little bit, and everybody's a unabashed history nerd. And that certainly applies to me too. So Dr. Charcot, he actually talked about this idea of a dynamic lesion or a functional lesion, that he didn't have a microscope powerful enough to detect this lesion, and he was quite prescient because functional neurological disorder, although it's not thought of as a structural lesion, there is a growing body of literature that shows that the brain of somebody with FND lights up differently compared to the brain of somebody without FND, and that is typically on a fMRI scan. The networks that have been implicated in FND, they span a lot of higher cognitive function. So emotional construction and regulation is definitely involved. Self-agency, our perception that we will a behavior to happen. Networks that are responsible for prediction and prediction error processing. Are definitely contributing to how this condition manifests. So just to pause and talk about a couple of those for a moment. Prediction error. I think that's important to talk about first because it informs how we understand all the other manifestations of FND. And it's going to come up in our discussion a little bit later about what are some novel techniques that we can use to treat people with FND. So our brains, and I'm going to use work that has been talked about and studied by many, many people before me. And so I'm certainly not someone who's contributed to the primary literature about prediction error and prediction coding. And a lot of what I'm about to share in the context of FND, I want to credit my colleagues, Johannes Junggilligens, David Perez, and the foundational work of Lisa Feldman Barrett. I have absolutely no royalties from these, but I would encourage anyone to check out Dr. Feldman Barrett's book, How Emotions Are Made, as well as a book on prediction coding by Andy Clark, a cognitive philosopher called The Experience Machine, how prediction shapes our reality, the experience machine. Great, great works. So our brains had to make, if we're gonna personify our brains for a moment, throughout the course of natural selection, our brains had a difficult choice. And it was, how do I fit inside this hominid-sized cranium, but process information well enough that eventually it could achieve human consciousness. And how does the brain do that with metabolic efficiency? given that our brain accounts for only 2% of our body weight, but 20% of our daily glucose and energy requirements. The brain had to figure out a way to process all of this information quite efficiently. And if the brain depended just on raw sensory data, just visual input, auditory input, tactile sensation, all the primary senses, then there's no way it would be able to fit in our cranium as it is currently sized. We look like one of those like Marvel villains, where the where Mars Attacks villains, where the brain is so oversized. So what the brain figured out how to do was to use prediction to predict what was about to happen, or to predict what certain signals meant, either from the external environment or the internal environment. And these predictions are fundamentally based on what our prior experience and learning is. So I'm gonna give you an example. It's kind of hard for the podcast format, because as Zane has seen me do before, there's some images that you can use, and really illusionists and magicians, they leverage our predicting brain for visual illusions. So, but if you were to think about reaching your hand out and grabbing a mug of coffee, which I'm doing right now on my own desk. Before I start to move my hand, my brain predicts the proprioceptive sensations of my arm moving throughout space, the visual input of my hand hitting my retina, the sensation of the coffee cup in my hand, the temperature and texture of the coffee once it hits my mouth. My brain predicts all of that before any of it actually happens. And again, it does that based on all the prior times that I have drank coffee in a particular context. And then my brain receives all those sensory data that I just went through. And if the sensory data matches its predictions, great, wonderful, no biggie. That's your conscious perception, that's your reality. But if the sensory data does not match those predictions, we call that prediction error. And if we experience a prediction error, our brain says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 I didn't get it right. So I need to update my prediction for next time." And that is really the neurobiological process of learning, by updating and minimizing prediction error. Well,
So
go ahead.
can I see if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly?
Absolutely.
So you're saying your brain is going to form these network functions to predict whatever's going on in your environment as a way to efficiently process all of this input information. So instead of processing it in real time, you're saying that takes a lot of computational resources, which would be space limited in inside of your skull. It basically, you said it predicts what's going to happen based on prior experience. So it's going to find previous cues, previous stimuli, replay those events in the brain, as like a essentially just to save resources,
That's exactly right.
right?
Spot
And
on.
then when it doesn't match up, uh-oh, but now we have to correct that. And that's what you're saying.
You got
It
it. That's
matches
it.
up, you're good. It's like, you've replayed the event, it's happened real efficiently, everything's good, we're gonna move forward. It doesn't, you have a problem, and then you have to correct it somehow. How does that happen in terms of normal cognitive processes, and then I guess what's going to then lead into FND?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll add to that is that when our brain is making a prediction, it's just astonishing. So there's a number, lots and lots and lots of predictions that are getting calculated at the same time. And then, based on, again, experience and prior learning and context, one of those has a higher probability. And that ends up being the prediction that becomes your conscious perception. And so, again, if you have prediction error, meaning that the one probability that one out does not match the sensory input, our brains have a mismatch detector. And it detects the mismatch, it detects the error, and it says, all right, I now need to create another updated probabilistic prediction when I'm in this exact or similar, not exact, but similar context next time. And our brains are really good at doing that, unless really they're not. And when they're not, that leads to a number of neuropsychiatric conditions and symptoms, including functional neurological disorder. Now, prediction error and predictive processing, it's also likely playing a role in psychotic disorders where there is a detachment from what your perception is and the reality around you. It's likely playing a role in post-traumatic stress disorder when there might be misattributions to stimuli in the environment that are perceived as threats when they're not threatening. And oh, go ahead, Gopu. Yeah, absolutely.
How would you judge judgment error versus a prediction error, right? How do you
Forgive me, Gopu, say that one more time.
like how would you judge a judgment error versus a prediction error? For example, if I keep on doing stupid things versus if there is something actually clinical that's going on in my head that's is making me unable to correct those feedback loop mechanisms versus someone doing the same thing again and again and thinking that they have FND. So how would you differentiate that? Just a
That's a great, great question. So for functional neurological disorder, there are specific rule-in signs and symptoms that allow us to make a clinical diagnosis. For schizophrenia, there are specific criteria for meeting a clinical diagnosis. So I think that there is a distinction, right, between is somebody able to update their predictions, but still perhaps make a decision or make a choice that doesn't seem in the best of one's judgment. But as oftentimes is in human behavior and medicine, everything's dimensional. Everything's a spectrum. In medicine, we like to think that things are like cutoff categories, that, oh, you meet the definition of this category for a diagnosis or this category for a diagnosis. And this all kind of leads into the book called the DSM, where there are specific diagnostic criteria. However, something I always say to students when they're training with me is that while the DSM is a helpful construct, it is definitely not how the brain works. And that's because whether it's cognition or emotion or perception, it's quite dimensional. And somebody might find themselves on an extreme of a certain dimension of brain function that we may consider pathologic, that we might consider a disorder, a diagnosis. So the line between what is a normal variation, for lack of a better word, normal, I try to avoid that word, a normal variation of human behavior versus a clinical diagnosis, that it's really on a spectrum, a dimensional rather than a categorical approach. But for FND specifically, it is not a diagnosis of exclusion. So for far too long, people have thought about FND as, well, we do this million-dollar workup, and nothing comes back showing an abnormal lab or a lesion in the brain. So, well, must be functional. That's dangerous. That is not how FND should be diagnosed. It's not how it is diagnosed.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Please.
So, from what I understand, FND seems like an umbrella term for different types of disorders that seems to have problem with cognition and, well, prediction, if I'm not wrong. So, one question is, so if there are different disorders, what ties them? Like, what are the commonalities between all of them, first thing. And second question, I study astrocytes in the field of substance use disorders. So do you think non-neuronal cells play a role in all these processes? This is way out there, but just wanted to ask.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I'm glad you did. So FND can take on many different forms or phenomenologies, phenotypes. You can have FND that is a seizure, FND that is a weak limb or a paralyzed limb, FND that is a tremor, FND that is vision loss. Basically, any motor or sensory neurological function could be a manifestation of FND. All of those different neurological processes, somebody could present with an impairment in them that could be caused by FND. And it is a very heterogeneous disorder. So someone might have a seizure subtype, someone might have a weakness subtype, a motor subtype, a tremor subtype. One of the things that we do observe clinically is that many people have mixed subtypes. So they might have seizures and paralysis. They might have tremor and weakness. They might have a combination of different types. And what that says to me, in part, what I think explains that heterogeneity and the evolution of symptoms over time is that there's something upstream. And I think that is where this core, at least in part, core challenge or dysfunction in how the brain is making predictions could unite all the different subtypes. Now, we're talking about predictive processing, but also, again, emotion construction and regulation, self-agency, attention allocation, the salience network. There's a lot of different networks at play, we believe, in FND. That certainly have their own body of research and literature, but really seemingly, I think close to the core is this idea of aberrant prediction error processing.
So how do you, sorry, how do you confirm that then, to distinguish between like epilepsy or, anxiety or ataxia or
Schizophrenia.
something? I mean, it seems like you're describing a little bit of everything. How do you distinguish FND from those different things? Because it's, if you take the historical context of it, I've always kind of, from my understanding from the neuroscience history, like the H word, right, was just a really gross misunderstanding of a lot of things crammed into one word. And then as we've learned more about the brain and how the brain works and how the nervous system works, then we start formalizing smaller subsets of what those could be classified as. I mean, there's a lot of fields, especially in neuroscience now, that are going through this revolution where they're even coming up with smaller categories of different syndromes within different disorders, right? How does FND, as Gopu kind of said, is it does sound like an umbrella for a lot of things. How do you make it distinct between you have epilepsy and you have some motor ataxia or something?
Absolutely. So, how do you feel confident in the diagnosis? I think is another
Yeah, what type of evidence do you look for
right.
to formulate your diagnosis?
Yeah. So, taking the seizure subtype and those positive rule-in signs and symptoms. So, there's psychiatrists like to say phenomenology, neurologists like to say semiology. So, there's semiology of seizures. What can you see with your eye when you observe a person having a clinical seizure? So there's a lot of great research about sensitivities and specificities for these semiologic features. I think some to highlight is that the gold standard for diagnosing what we would call functional seizures, the seizure subtype of FND, is that somebody comes into the hospital to the epilepsy monitoring unit, to the EMU. And the way that I talk about this with patients is that the EMU is the space to come and figure out what is causing your seizures. So seizure itself does not imply epilepsy by the root etymology of the word. It means to lose control of the body. You can have epileptic seizures. You can have physiologic seizures, like syncopal seizures. You can have functional seizures. And so the EMU helps us by putting electrodes on the scalp. And when you have a typical seizure, your neurologist will be able to look at the EEG, the electroencephalogram, and say, do we see evidence of this excessive hypersynchronous electrochemical activity, the spikes and waves that you would expect to see on an EEG if someone were having an epileptic seizure? And the features that we look for in the semiology, some of them include if somebody's eyes are closed during the seizure, that's much more suggestive of a functional seizure rather than an epileptic seizure. Epileptic seizures, you typically would see the eyes open. If there's actual resistance to opening the eyes, much more consistent with functional rather than epileptic. If somebody is having convulsions on both sides of their body, if that were an epileptic seizure, it means both hemispheres are seizing. And so, by definition, someone would not be able to retain conscious awareness during the seizure. If somebody does have bilateral convulsions and is able to recall what's happening in their surroundings at that time, that's much, much more indicative of a functional seizure than an epileptic seizure. And those are just a few. There's tons and tons and tons that have been researched and sensitivities and specificities that we know. And you can't hang your hat on just one of them. I think that's an important take-home point. You do want to look for a constellation of them to say, okay, these running together, in the absence of epileptic activity on the EEG, rules in the diagnosis of FND. And then there's similar types of examination findings that we can do to rule it in for, again, the movement subtypes and so forth.
So if a patient comes and if you have diagnosed them for FND, what next? Right?
You bet.
For example, what are the lifestyle changes that patient after diagnosis needs to be aware of? What are we as researchers need to be aware of? How can it be treated?
Yeah,
Like, what
what's
going
the
on?
impact on that patient for
Yeah.
sure?
Right. I'm a clinician, and I am a big believer that the interview is just as much of an intervention as it is about gathering data. So when I am meeting a patient who's presenting to our FND multidisciplinary program at UT Southwestern, we're a big team. I am just one member of a very large team that makes this program work for people. When I'm meeting somebody for the first time, I start by saying that it's important for me to get to understand what's been happening to them, their medical history, but just as important, if not more so, to start to get to know them as a human being, as a person. And I'm reminded of William Osler's famous quote that the good clinician the good clinician oh, you're going to have to edit this out.
Nope, sorry.
It's the good clinician knows the disease, the great clinician knows the person
Hey.
the disease, but I'm still paraphrasing, but we're gonna have to edit that out. So I'm one member of a very large team that makes this program for us work for patients who have FND. And when I'm meeting someone for the first time, I begin by saying I want to get to know about their medical history, how they've been doing recently, but just as important, if not the most important, to get to know them as a person. And I explicitly say that their symptoms are not made up, their symptoms are not faked, things that many people
Oh, I
have
bet.
heard throughout the course of their illness, sometimes from other clinicians.
Oh my gosh.
And to validate that what they're experiencing is genuinely experienced. It is real. It is not of their own imagination. And that it's brain-based. And that becomes the start of treatment.
Can you maybe share most common things you see in patients? I mean, is seizures and epilepsy or these seizure types the most common, or are there other things? So when they say, "I've been told this isn't real and I'm making it up," I can imagine what that is, but what would you say the most common symptoms are that people say that about?
Absolutely, yeah. The most common subtypes of FND are the functional seizure subtype and functional movement disorders, and within functional movement disorders, functional tremors. And in thinking about the communication of the diagnosis itself, and the treatment, we really do utilize a biopsychosocial approach because we're thinking about those biological elements that are either predisposing vulnerabilities, acute precipitance, perpetuating factors. We're thinking about those three P's across biology, psychology, and the social elements. So if somebody has a structural neurological condition, for example, Parkinson's or epilepsy, that actually is a risk factor for FND. My colleagues published a wonderful paper in the Journal of Neuropsychiatry and Clinical Neurosciences last year that was looking at specific cerebrovascular lesions, stroke lesions in the brain that were then followed by the manifestation of FND. And those lesions were actually in networks that are implicated and we've known are implicated in FND. So the metaphor that we often use is this isn't a hardware problem, it's a software problem. That metaphor kind of starts to fall apart a little bit because it's a network challenge, and networks can be affected by many different things. But the treatment is multidisciplinary, and it includes oftentimes a neurologist to help us make the diagnosis, a psychiatrist or neuropsychiatrist who can really be there to think about, are there mental health comorbidities like depression, PTSD, anxiety disorders that we need to be thinking about co-treating, but also helping coordinate treatments with psychotherapists, maybe physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, rehabilitative therapists who assist as well in the treatment of FND. And psychotherapy, rehabilitative therapy, what those treatments are really about, in my opinion about this, is that they're helping the brain update its predictions. So my dear friends and colleagues, we psychiatrists, we were trained that every psychiatrist should have a psychotherapist. I'm a big believer in that. And whenever he's going to psychotherapy, he likes to say, "I'm going to update my predictions." And that's exactly right, is that psychotherapy, physical therapy, is laying down new networks, new pathways to think about things differently, to move differently. So it's its own way, a biological and psychological process.
So let's jump into TMS.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you use this approach to help improve your prediction?
Yeah, I love that question. Yeah. I know great conversation about TMS and its mechanisms and how it can stimulate networks by targeting particular regions in the brain. And so as this relates to FND, there's certainly a body of literature and some great meta-analyses and systematic reviews about the use of neuromodulation FND. I would encourage people to check out. But there's a couple different pathways this can work, right? One is a top-down pathway. So the idea that you're modulating a network in the brain that is subserving some higher cognitive function that will then influence symptoms downstream, whether it's a tremor or a convulsion of the body or a paralysis of a leg. The other potential is that it is a bottom-up process, that something happens in that distal part of the nervous system that then the brain detects, and it challenges its predictions, its expectations. So, for example, there is a case of someone who had functional blindness. And this is an anecdote from that book by Andy Clark, The Experience Machine, where the person had functional blindness. And this is an individual who had severe migraines and lived in darkness for days on end because of photophobia, and developed this experience, this genuine experience of blindness. But nothing was wrong with the optic nerve or the retina or the occipital lobe. There was no lesion in the brain. And eventually, what the team did was that they used TMS to stimulate the occipital cortex, and that created a phosphene. The person saw these flashing perceptions that the TMS induced, and then that helped them update their prediction that, oh, I can perceive light. So it wasn't that the TMS was actually modulating the occipital cortex network. These were just single stimuli. It wasn't repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation. But because of that induced perception, it allowed the brain to start predicting differently. And eventually, this individual was able to see again.
So this was like they would present them with some visual stimuli, pulse with the TMS, the magnetic pulse to kind of synchronize the stimulus and the association with the brain.
So there was no external stimulus. They would give a pulse
Oh,
to the
okay.
occipital cortex, and then that would induce neuronal firing that was perceived as a sphere or a geometric shape or some flash of light, even. It was probably just a simple flash of light. I think it
Yeah.
was, yeah.
So with this individual, their visual system was intact, right?
Correct.
Retina worked, optic nerve worked, goes all the way back to the visual cortex. I'm assuming the visual cortex was then still functional,
All structurally intact. That's
but
right.
not the networks weren't firing in the right pattern, and this was just synchronizing it in a way
That's exactly
that
right. I'm sorry. So it's pretty much like a circuit dysfunction.
A circuit dysfunction. That's right. Yes. A network dysfunction. That's exactly right.
Okay.
And another example of the kind of bottom up theory around TMS is for functional weakness. So you can stimulate the motor cortex
Right.
just with a single pulse. It's not enough to induce the neuromodulation that we think about with the use of TMS for depression or OCD. Just a single pulse, and you can make your thumb twitch. And in somebody who's experiencing their limb as paralyzed, and the thumb twitches, that starts to send bottom-up signals that challenges the prior expectation that the limb is paralyzed, so that they might be able to start updating what they anticipate and predict for that limb. Now that's bottom-up, but there's also very much a reason to think about top-down. So a case series that was done. Large group, including my colleague David Perez, who was part of this case series. And for this, they were specifically treating people who had the seizure subtype, functional seizures. And what they did was they stimulated, in an excitatory way, the temporoparietal junction, the right TPJ. And this is believed, based on some earlier functional imaging from Valerie Voon and many others, that supports the idea that the right TPJ is a hub in the network that attempts to detect mismatches between, again, prediction and sensory input. And if the mismatch detector is underactive, hypoactive, not working the way that it should, then you can't update your expectations for later. And they stimulated the right TPJ, and this was a case series of about seven or eight people, and the majority had a rapid and sustained response months later with seizure freedom. So this was not a sham controlled. It was open label, so not the strongest clinical trial in terms of evidence, but it was some pilot data that really started to launch the field to think about neuromodulation, TMS, as a means of treating FND.
Are there with FND, are there, I mean, you're describing a lot of sensory issues, like predictive values with sensory, like visual cortex, motor cortex. Are there non-sensory level prediction errors, like with affect or mood disorders? I mean, you mentioned like psychiatric disorders where what is real and what is not real can be disrupted. What about, anxiety? I mean, for sure, depression for they've used for TMS, but is there an FND component to depression, or is depression a part of FND?
You got it. Yeah, I'll speak to exactly that, and then that might be a nice segue into the pilot study that we're about to launch
Oh, yeah, sure.
in Southwestern. Yeah, so Dr. Feldman-Barrett, I mentioned earlier, How Emotions Are Made, great book, really changed the paradigm of how I think about the brain and behavior. So when I was a student in undergrad, I was taught that there were emotional categories that were universal. We're born with them. They're ingrained in our brain from early on, and that they are shared across cultures. And more contemporary research has really turned that understanding on its head. And this is what Dr. Feldman-Barrett and others call the constructionist theory of emotion, that much like our perception, picking up this coffee mug, is informed by the predictions that we make, so are our emotional constructs. So when we are little tiny babies, when we're going through infancy and then adolescence, we are developing our minds based on the world around us and what we learn, but also the signals that are coming from inside of our body, the rate of how we're breathing, our heart rate, the sensations of our stomach, our muscles, and our joints, and our skin. So much information is being fed to the brain. And sometimes that's on a conscious level. Like you're ever sitting around and all of a sudden you're like hyper aware of how you're breathing and how deep you're breathing or your stomach growling. But most of the time, all that information is reaching our brain at an unconscious level. And that's what we call interception. Interoception is our brain's constant mapping of our body's internal states. And it plays a really important role in how we experience our emotions, how we experience and construct our feelings. For example, let's say that somebody is walking down the aisle and they see the love of their life just ahead of them at the altar, and their heart rate starts to beat. Well, that means excitement, that means love. But let's say the next week they're in one of those skyscrapers in Chicago and they look down and it's a glass floor and 70 stories below them and their heart rate starts to beat. Well, they have all those other contextual cues that, ooh, this is fear. Well, what if an individual, due to trauma, due to neglect, they never had the opportunity to construct multiple categories for what does increased heart rate mean in this given context? They didn't have that richness of social reciprocity and secure attachments growing up. And maybe the only construct their mind had developed was when your heart is beating fast, that means panic, that means danger, that means fear. So that whenever that happens, The only construct they have is to experience fear. And this ends up playing out in FND as well, because if somebody doesn't have emotional granularity, perhaps the way they experience those interoceptive signals and that their predictions are not accurately or precisely interpreting them, it may ultimately end up as a physical manifestation, as a neurological manifestation. We think that this might play a role in what we have historically called somatization, the idea of emotional life becomes, to use the old Freud term, converted into a physical symptom. But we now have a lot more science and neuroscience and the neuroscience of interoception and emotional construction to understand this in a more nuanced way. What we're hoping to do with TMS is that there has been a protocol developed for OCD that uses deep TMS. And you can target prefrontal structures like the anterior cingulate cortex. Well, turns out the anterior cingulate cortex is part of our predictive processing network. It turns out the anterior cingulate cortex has reciprocal connections to a part of the brain called the insula. And the insula, a really important structure and region with lots of connections to networks in the brain, the insula seems to play a really important processing role in associating what our interoceptive signals are with our emotional states. And we hope that by modulating the anterior cingulate cortex, that this will do two have reached two goals for treating FND. One is to help the brain make more accurate predictions, and two is to help modulate the ways in which our internal bodily states are associated with emotional experiences. And we're going to pair it with some particular psychotherapeutically informed interventions. So it's not just about stimulating, but it's about stimulating in certain brain states. We're really excited. I want to give shout outs to many people who have been important to the development of that project, including Austin Beltran, an incredibly brilliant and talented neurology resident who is working with our team.
So, I mean that's very cool, very exciting too, to be able to have some sort of non-invasive way to kind of modulate this prediction error to maybe help improve its ability to predict accurately, right, at these contexts. That's cool.
Got it. Yeah, we're
I
super.
think you kind of have answered this throughout what you've discussed with. Especially FND. And I'm kind of trying to put this together in my own brain on how like TMS changes these network states to improve this predictive error. But I don't know if we've actually outright called this to the forefront, but like what causes FND? Is this, I think you kind of just mentioned a little bit like maybe there's some sort of psychological trauma that shifts this. It's clearly not a structural thing, right? You said early on it's not necessarily a lesion. It's not like an injury, tumor, not necessarily. What in your context, what causes an individual to present with FND?
You bet. Thinking about that biopsychosocial formulation again, that's how we understand the risk factors too. So, in regards to trauma, I think it's important to say out loud that the presence of trauma does not rule in the diagnosis of FND
So
and
you're
the.
saying, sorry, physical trauma or psychological trauma?
Great set of questions. Psychological trauma. To
Okay.
start with, the presence of psychological trauma does not rule in the diagnosis of FND. The absence of psychological trauma does not rule out the diagnosis. I think that's
Wow, that's
really
tough.
important for diagnosticians to know. Also, there are many, many patients that we meet who have no immediately identifiable psychological stressor, psychiatric diagnosis, history of trauma, and they absolutely do have FND. Now, those parts of their history or experience, they might come up in the course of longitudinal treatment, but at the time of diagnosis, there are many people where that is not the case. And that's why I think it is so important for trainees to know that the absence of it does not rule it out, and the presence of it does not rule it in. Lots and lots of risk factors. So a history of neglect or abuse, a history of another known neurological condition, including epilepsy, including multiple sclerosis, stroke, Parkinson's, all of those can be risk factors for FND. A history of a physical trauma, a concussion or an injury to the limb, certain personality structures, such as if somebody has a personality dimension that is maybe further on the end of the spectrum with regards to neuroticism or obsessionality, those are associated with higher risk of developing FND. Alexithymia, the psychological idea of it is really hard for people to recognize emotions or to put words to verbalizing their emotions. Alexithymia, the absence of words for thymia. The Greeks used to think that our emotions were in our thymus, in our chest. So that's
Oh,
carried over
I've
the years.
not heard that.
So lots of different potential risk factors, again, that span the biological, psychological, and sociodevelopmental spheres. And I also want to take a moment to highlight how FND is connected to other conditions that many of us are familiar with. So phantom limb is all
Yes.
about the predicting brain. If somebody needs to have an amputation due to an injury, but let's say before they had that surgery, that limb suffered from pain a great deal. Even though the limb is now amputated, the tissue is no longer there. The pain and the sensation of the body being present is mapped centrally. And what happens is that some brilliant neuroscientists developed the mirror box to treat phantom limb pain, where you actually put your arms into a box that uses a mirror to deceive your brain, to deceive your eyes, to perceive that your amputated limb is still there, so that a therapist can massage out the pain. And by visualizing that, by seeing that happen in the mirror, you're tricking your brain to perceiving therapy in the limb that has been removed so that the map can be updated. Your predictions about the limb can be updated. Complex regional pain syndrome, when maybe there's a crush injury to the foot, the tissue heals. There's no more nociceptive pain that's happening, but there's now a centralized pain. And so your perception of the pain in the absence of structural lesions is extremely real and very distressing. Fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, these are all conditions that we think these underlying mechanisms are at play, as well as an FND.
Wow.
Okay. Well, I honestly feel like I can ask more questions for another 5 hours, right? I have so many questions. But this has been fascinating. I've got a list of books now I've got to go read. Thanks, Chad.
Oh, yeah, they're great. I
Oh,
do a lot of audiobooks, so I know they all come in audiobooks.
good.
I've written down how emotions are made.
I want to thank you so much. This was tremendous. So I appreciate the time. I know you're probably super busy. You mentioned before we started talking, last week was match week, and you guys have had so much going on. So I appreciate for taking the time to sit down with Gopu and I and chat about everything that you've shared with us. So.
Oh my gosh, it's been so fun for me. I'm really grateful for the opportunity. Speaking of match day, just as a quick note to our learners out there, if you're thinking about a career in neuropsychiatry, there is a pathway through a combined residency in which at the end you're dual trained as a neurologist and a psychiatrist. It's a 6-year residency program after medical school. There's also a fellowship route. So after residency, you can pursue a fellowship in what's called behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry, or BNNP for short. Several programs throughout North America that are accredited, and two awesome pathways if you find yourself interested in neuropsychiatry.
No, we hope so.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
Thank
all so much. Have a great rest of your day.
you. You.